Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Oscar Nominee Series 2014. Tonight we speak with Best Adapted Screenplay nominee, Billy Ray. Billy Ray is one of our most original and gifted screenwriters, from intimate portraits like Shattered Glass and Breach, both of which he also directed, to the biggest blockbusters like The Hunger Games. He infuses each work with a beautiful insight and high drama. Never has that been more true than with his screenplay for Captain Phillips, the intense thriller starring Tom Hanks that became one of the great screen successes released in the past year. Captain Phillips also represents Mr. Ray's first Oscar nomination. I gotta tell you, it's such a thrill to have an opportunity to speak to you because you've been an absolute favorite of mine for many years, so thank you for agreeing, first of all.
Oh, no. Thank you very much. It's flattering to be asked.
I want to start with Captain Phillips because I've been reading about your involvement in the film, and my understanding is that you lobbied for it. So when you went to the powers that be and pitched your idea for it, what was that initial notion, and how did it evolve as you actually wrote it?
Well, start with the idea that, you know, screenwriters go hunting for stories all the time. You know, we're always looking for that gem. And for me personally, the field is a little bit narrower because I love true stories. I tend to gravitate towards them. So when you find a story like this, it's, first of all, a true story. But then beyond that, it's got great characters, great politics sort of baked into it. It's got, you know, action set pieces. It's got everything. And it's got an ending that is both satisfying and thrilling and oddly kind of sad. You just don't find that every day. So it was a job that I wanted very, very badly. Let me start with that. I knew I'd be competing with other writers to go get it, but that was fine. For a job like this, I'm happy to compete. What I basically said when I went into those initial meetings was, this is a story about two captains. And they both get up in the morning and get dressed and go to work, but their work puts them on a collision course. One of them is very much a part of a global economy. The other is not at all a part of a global economy, but they're both buffeted by these political winds over which they have no control. And then ultimately, it's a story about leadership. It's about how Captain Phillips leads and about how Musi, who's the lead pirate, leads, and what they do for their men, and which one is ultimately successful in his leadership style. That's what the movie was for me.
You're expressing a very strong idea that you came into them with.
Yes.
When you're writing it, how much is just trying to articulate those ideas, and how much is actually a process of discovery and finding new ideas in the writing?
Well, you have to be open to both. But look, do you know how to do the sculpture of an elephant? You start with a block of granite, and you chip away everything that's not an elephant, right? There's no other way to make a sculpture of an elephant.
Right.
So when you tell a story like this, your block of granite is all the research that you do. That's every book you can get your hands on. In this case, Captain Phillips had written a book. But it's also interviews with him. It's interviews with his family. It's everything. It's every piece of information you can possibly gather. And that's your block of granite. When you have it all in front of you, and it's, you know, 10 times more information about the world of your story than you actually are going to need on screen, then you take a step back from it, and you say, okay, where's the elephant in there? And for me, the elephant still became this idea of leadership. Two men, two captains, how they lead, how they influence each other once they're stuck in a room together. If you look at it through that kind of lens, it becomes really clear which event choices you need to make in order to tell that particular story. And then everything else starts to fall away.
We got a problem. We pushed the ship too hard. We're off the grid. That means the computer's now offline.
Captain.
The ship's broken.
Captain, no one gets hurt if you don't play no game.
The ship's broken. We had to go.
Nobody gets hurt. Easy.
Hey!
Look at me.
Sure.
Look at me.
Sure.
I'm the captain now. Did I go first?
And what's so striking about it is that I would imagine you probably wrote the film possibly with Tom Hanks in mind, but mm-hmm. but his casting in the film is just works out so beautifully because he has such a naturally empathetic, everymanish quality.
There was never any other actor who I considered for the part as I was writing it, but that doesn't mean anything. I'm just the writer. You always write with a fantasy actor in your head. That said, I've never once gotten my fantasy actor. You always write and hope for this, you know, one dream guy, and it's never the guy you wind up with, but in this case it was. Hanks was the only guy who I could imagine playing Captain Phillips. He was right for it on every possible level, and we wound up getting him, which was, you know, one of the high water marks of my life, if not my career.
Because we all love him so much that we're almost programmed to respond empathetically with him. So it's an enormous surprise when you watch the movie that it is a true two-hander, and you have equal empathy with the lead pirate played by Barkhad.
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't think of it in terms of empathy because I don't think we were trying to justify piracy. I think the mm-hmm. idea was, and by the way, this would have been impossible if I didn't have a director who really cared about this. I was very fortunate that I did. We wanted people to understand what the life of the average Somali is like. We wanted people to understand that these people don't wake up in the morning and go apply for a job at Walmart. You know, that doesn't exist in Somalia. That they are the product of their environment, and it's not an easy place to grow up, and it's not an easy place to live. You know, you always want to dimensionalize your characters, especially your bad guys. And that's all I was trying to do there, was make him a real person.
What do you think they get from one another? What do they teach each other something in the course of the movie?
I certainly hope so. What Musi is seeing in Captain Phillips is a guy who is trying to protect his crew. And that's at exactly the moment where Musi is putting his crew in greatest danger. You know, what is it that Captain Phillips can learn from Musi? I think he's seeing in Musi, you know, the desperation of his circumstances. And I think Captain Phillips is getting his eyes opened a little bit. But you can see by the end, Captain Phillips is begging that youngest pirate, Bilal, mm-hmm. begging him to get off that lifeboat because he knows that they're all going to get their heads blown off. And you yeah. hear him say, "You're just a kid, you're just a kid, you know, get out of here." He develops, I can't really call it empathy for them, but he certainly develops some kind of human understanding of who they are in the world they came from.
You must have spoken to Captain Phillips throughout the writing of this project. That has to be an extra feeling of responsibility you have to be faithful to his story and to his history, essentially.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, when you tell a true story, you have to get the facts right. You have to get the characters right. You have to capture who they actually are. You know, that's true of any true story, and I've written, you know, several of them now, but I try not to look at that as an impediment. I try to look at that as an opportunity because, you know, I don't think I can create a better character than Captain Phillips. I can't create a better character than Musi. So, you know, God did the work for me, which is nice, and I'm the beneficiary of that.
Yeah. I hear actors say, and this quote always comes to mind when I think of a few of your films, I hear actors say that when they're researching a character, it's more important for them to ask the questions than provide the answers. And I'm wondering if that sentiment resonates for you at all as a writer.
Well, it's certainly true of the research you're doing when you're writing a movie. You know, by that point, you have the job, right? Your auditioning phase is over. So you don't need to impress anybody with how smart you are. You're better off just going and asking a lot of questions and learning so that you can create that big block of granite that I referred to earlier.
Well, I'm thinking about Shattered Glass and especially Breach. You're dealing with these very kind of enigmatic, almost mercurial characters, and I think it's to both of those films' credits that they don't attempt to explain their behavior in some pat form.
Our actions define us, right? We are what we do. What are the three ways in a movie that you can find out something about a character? One, what the character says about himself. That's hugely unreliable because people lie all the time. Two is what other people say about that character, also hugely unreliable, because people might be looking at that character with their own personal animus or their own personal bias. They might be jealous, they might be angry, they might be in love. There's a lot of reasons why people can assess other people incorrectly. The only thing that really defines who someone is what they do, their behavior. Mm-hmm. And if their behavior is the opposite of what they say about themselves, all the better. Because it means that everything they're going to be doing in that movie is going to be loaded with subtext and it's going to be really interesting.
We're looking into a conference that was held here a couple Sundays ago. Computer hackers. You remember anything like that?
Are you sure you're in the right building, sir?
Yes, we're sure. Why's that?
Building's closed on Sunday.
All I know is I was here. The conference was right here. That's why the Russells only stayed a few minutes, okay? Because it was such a dumb place to squeeze into. So they went to a restaurant for dinner with some of Ian's hacker friends.
Thank you. How many?
Huh?
People at the dinner, how many?
About 10, I think. Including me. Ian even put on a jacket.
Hyatt was there too?
Yeah.
Is it near here?
Yeah, it's across the street.
Good, let's cross the street.
You know, I really don't like the way you're treating me, Chuck. It's like you won't even talk to me.
This is the place.
Yes. I didn't do anything wrong, okay? I didn't do anything wrong. You saw my notes. Everything was in there. I got tricked. I got fooled. I'm sorry. What are you being so mad for?
It was 10 people.
Yes.
For dinner.
Yes.
They're closed at 3 on Sundays.
Yeah, I know. I know, they almost didn't let us in. Okay, but it was a couple of minutes before 3, and Ian looked like he was about ready to cry, and so they said okay.
For dinner?
Go in and ask him yourself, Chuck. Okay, go in and see if they would serve a party that came in at 2:58, and the answer would be yes, because that's when we got here.
The Forbes guys are going to have all this, too, and they're going to dig through the records
wrong,
at that office building. Okay, I'm sure they have surveillance cameras, and they're going to check them.
I didn't do anything wrong, Chuck.
I really wish you'd stop saying that.
When you're telling a true story, what you have is the benefit of history. You know, in Breach, I knew what Robert Hansen had done. I could juxtapose that against what he said about himself. In Shattered Glass, the same was true of Stephen Glass. I knew what he said about himself, and I knew what he had actually done. And those juxtapositions defined those two characters. Well, you know, the same is true when you're telling the story like Captain Phillips. You know, what did this guy do? Under pressure, which is when we always reveal who we actually are, under pressure, this guy, making the toughest choice of his life, chose to get in that lifeboat to save his crew. That's who he is at his core.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of why you want to make a movie about him, because he has that kind of ethic, because he has that kind of character.
So there was no feeling of, with Glass or Hansen, for you as a writer-director, of embracing what remained elusive about both of those people, or were they at all elusive to you?
Well, you mean, did I have access to talk to them?
Well, I think in a lot of movies, and I've heard you talk about the screenplays that have most influenced you, and and a lot of them come from 70s cinema, and I think about 70s cinema, and I think about these very complicated characters that you can't explain away. I mean, you got to grapple with them.
Yes, that's right.
And I was wondering if there's anything kind of elusive in their characters, and if you're okay with that, or if you really have to define everything about them before you can write them and commit to them.
No, to me, it's really, I'm not here to do psychology on them. I'm
okay.
Here to say, here's what they said about themselves, here's what they actually did. And then the audience draws their own conclusion about who those people are.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, I want to know, because we talked about the screenplays that inspire you, I want to get into those, but also, first of all, your entry into screenwriting, I would imagine your father was a tremendous kind of influence of that, because he was a literary agent, wasn't he?
He was. My father was a literary agent and had a sterling reputation and was one of the finest agents in the business. He had an incredible list. He represented people like Frank Pearson, Peter Bogdanovich, Paul Brickman, Alvin Sargent, Carol Sobieski. You know, he had an incredible list. When I told him that I wanted to be a screenwriter, you know, back in those days, agencies still kept all their clients' scripts, you know, on paper in these big metal stacks in the back of the agency. So when I said, "Dad, I want to be a screenwriter," I was 19. He said, "Come here." And I followed him to the back of the office, and there were those stacks, and he pulled out from the stack a copy of the script Ordinary People, written by his client Alvin Sargent. And he handed it to me and said, "Here, do this." And that's where he was setting the bar for me, which, you know, I've been trying to hit ever since. And I've been fortunate enough to actually tell Alvin Sargent that story, because I've gotten to know him a little bit over the course of the last 10, 15 years. You know, those are the giants for me. Those are the guys that I'm trying to match up with.
And when you think about Ordinary People, what are the aspects of that script that speak most to you? And what are you aiming for in that script?
Well, there are two things in that script in particular. One, whenever you're writing, you want to give your characters a dilemma. And a great dilemma is one in which a character is choosing between two things of equal value. And both of them are things that matter to the character. And if they can be things that matter desperately to the character, all the better. Ordinary People is constructed in such a way where Donald Sutherland, at the end of the movie, has to choose between his wife and their son. That's a spectacular dilemma.
Yeah.
Because in a great dilemma, you're going to reveal who the character is under the utmost pressure. Obviously, the tougher the dilemma, the more revealing the choice, which is why, as a screenwriter, you're constantly trying to put dilemmas in front of your characters so that we can find out who they are. Well, in that movie, you find out who that guy is, and it's a slow burn, and it's just beautifully, beautifully done. The other thing about that movie, which I didn't really realize until I was deep into my career, is that if you go back and look at Ordinary People, it's actually the perfect monster movie. It's constructed exactly like a monster movie, and except Mary Tyler Moore is the monster. If you think of it in those terms, you know, what is a monster movie? It's an ordinary person who's got a problem, and at first he's unaware of it. He doesn't realize there's a monster there. And then at a certain point, he figures out there's a monster there, but it's too late because the monster's already now started to do some damage. And then it's, what's he going to do? How's he going to square off against the monster and beat it? And that's what Ordinary People is.
Do you find that the 70s were, in generally, one of the greatest decades for filmmaking? And what are movies today, what are they missing that the 70s films had, do you think?
Well, for me, it's unquestionably the greatest decade for filmmaking. I don't see how anyone could make the argument for any other decade. I just don't think any other
decade so too.
Was close. It had a lot of things going for it. First of all, studios were run then by gunslingers, you know what I mean, people who actually made got decisions on what kind of movies to make in a very different way than studios are greenlighting movies today. There was no such thing as CGI then, which has encouraged a very lazy kind of storytelling just because now any image is possible, so studios are just making tentpoles and only interested in those trailer kind of moments as opposed to actual development of character and story. But the other critical element is, in the 70s, you had an audience that was ready to embrace angry movies. You know, the audience had come out of Vietnam and Watergate, and if you look at all the great 70s movies, they're almost all anti-institutional in one way or another. And the audience embraced that. They wanted movies that articulated what was really happening around them in a way that we've stopped trying to do, at least lately, at least on the studio side. You know, at a certain point, the idea that that superheroes really existed in the world kind of took hold in Hollywood, but that didn't exist in the 70s. You know, in the 70s, people were making movies with real bad guys, real problems, real solutions, kind of ugly truths, but there was a beauty to it.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you completely. I mean, I find that what was most exciting about the 70s cinema, and I think this is reflected in the culture at large as well, there was an engagement in the world around them. And I find that less so today, but with something like Captain Phillips that speaks so profoundly to so many things that we're dealing with now in our economic environment, just between the haves and the have-nots, I think that your film is incredibly relevant to today.
Well, thank you. I mean, there's also a metaphor going on there that I don't think I even realized until I was done with the script, which is, in some ways, what's going on between Captain Phillips and those pirates and the Navy is a little bit representative of where America is in terms of the geopolitics of the world. And by that I mean, you know, if 9/11 showed us anything, it's that you can have the greatest military in the world and still be susceptible to a couple crazy people on a plane. Mm-hmm. And part of the bones of Captain Phillips is you've got these three gigantic destroyers with all the hardware in the world, and they're chasing this little rinky-dink lifeboat, you know, with four scrawny pirates on it. But for a little while, the pirates have the upper hand. And that, to me, felt like a metaphor for, you know, where America is in terms of the war on terror.
Absolutely. Before I let you go, I want to ask you just two more quick questions. One about a future project. Is The Last Tycoon, is that happening?
It's happening in that I have written the pilot. I'm waiting to see if the movie will be greenlit. I mean, if the pilot will be greenlit. If so, I'll direct it and hopefully run the series.
Oh, my gosh. That's a dream. It's
been writing bliss.
Is this, like, planned for a mini-series or a series?
No. It's a regular series at HBO. I've written the Bible for the show, which lays out the first 5 years of the show, and I hope to get to tell that whole story.
Oh, goodness. Thinking about Fitzgerald, you know, I think that there has been mixed success with bringing his works to the screen in the past. And I'm curious from you, are some novels unadaptable?
Oh, I'm sure that's true. Some novels are very, very tough to adapt. You know, The Last Tycoon is the only novel he didn't finish.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds presumptuous to say that we're going to go finish something for F. Scott Fitzgerald. I don't mean it in that way. What I mean is it was an introduction to a couple characters and the power dynamic between them and the world in which they were doing battle. But that's really all we're taking from it. You know, the first year of our series is set in 1936, which is where the book is. But by the end of our series, we're in 1945. We're into, you know, a world that Fitzgerald never even got to see himself, much less write about.
So, and last question about the Academy Award nomination, and congratulations on the WGA, by the way. That was incredible. I started cheering when I saw the results from the WGA. So,
thank you very much.
Tell me what it feels like. Is this your first nomination?
It is. I have to tell you, it's something I've wanted very, very badly for a very long time. And, you know, what a great tip of the cap for any writer. It's such a great feeling. But the fun of it has been muted a little bit because Tom Hanks wasn't nominated, and that just kills me. And Paul wasn't nominated, Paul Greengrass, our director. And I feel that they both really deserved it. So as much as I'm thrilled for me, I feel like my team didn't get what it deserved, and particularly those two guys didn't get what they deserved. And like I said, that took a little of the shine off it for me.
Yeah, yeah. But while your work is incredible, and so thank you so much for the work that you do, and best of luck with the Last Tycoon. I hope that gets off the ground, because it's a project I can't wait to see.
You and me both, and I look forward to our next conversation about it.